Welcome to Entrepreneurs the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer, and I'm blessed to be over the pond in London with probably the greatest podcaster that I've been with of the thousands of podcasts that I've been involved with, the amazing Brian Rose. The London Reel is absolutely one of the most fascinating, engaged, and for me, valuable content, both as a podcaster and as a guest. We are blessed to have an incredible entrepreneur, also almost mayor, which I thought was super cool as well. Thanks for joining me, Brian.
My pleasure. Thanks
good
for having
to see
me.
You, brother.
Good to see you, too.
So one of the things that you and I have learned over the years is the power of media. And I don't know if you knew exactly, like Gary did, where this media thing was going. He sure does a great job of framing it like he knows where it's going. That's why all he's talking about now, speaking of real, is analog, and everything's going back to real. I personally show up in person more than anyone I know, but I capture what I do in person to create the virtual.
Right.
And then while I'm in person places, I do virtual shit to entertain myself and other people, because virtual stuff can be done anywhere, especially now that these unbelievable formats can be seen on a phone. What was your original intention with building a media company?
Yeah, it's a great question. And media has changed so much over the past 15 years. Look, I was working in a bank in London. I had a 15-year career, started on Wall Street, came to London, was about 10 years down in the city. I was kind of one of those city boys. I was turning 40, and on paper, on LinkedIn, I looked like I had the greatest life ever. But I was miserable, just miserable. I was making millions of pounds a year. I had the duplex place in Shoreditch, and I could vacation wherever I wanted. But I just didn't find it very creative. And I think we all know somebody in banking that just doesn't really enjoy the work. And I actually took a meditation course that year and walked out of it like 2 weeks later. And I thought, what the hell am I doing? What am I doing? And I grew up in the States, California, and I always thought money would make me happy. And I actually had some data points. We used to get paid quarterly at the place I worked in the city. And I could literally prop my wealth going up, and I could plot my happiness going down. Mm. And I'm an engineer from MIT. And after 15 years, I finally figured that out. And I thought I need to do something different. I was a huge fan of Joe Rogan before anybody knew who Joe Rogan was, before he was ever on YouTube. I was watching him on Vimeo. I was training jiu-jitsu since 2002. So I knew him from the UFC. And that's how I knew he had a podcast. And I watched his early podcast where it was three dudes on a sofa on a Ustream. It was terrible production. But quite frankly, those videos changed my life. I was not hanging out with cool dudes like that, having cool conversations. And I would watch a 3-hour episode on a Sunday with him and Aubrey Marcus talking about ayahuasca.
Yeah,
and I would
right
finish
on.
That and I would just be, and that music play at the end. And I'd be like, wow, like in a weird way, that was a spiritual experience somehow. Like I couldn't get that in my life. I was this grumpy banker and I couldn't get it. And I thought, man, there's something here. So I just quit my job and finally had the balls to start my own show about 10 months later. And I remember knowing video was important because there were people starting these audio podcasts and I just knew you couldn't create a relationship with someone. And I just knew that was important. And I also, the name, I always thought London was the greatest brand name in the world, right? The London School of Sound, the London Eye Institute. It is, I think, one of the greatest brand names. So I thought we'd call it London. It was originally going to be like London Real Deal, like Real Deal Holyfield.
Yeah.
But we killed the deal at the end. So just London Real. And it was not supposed to be a business. It was just me pursuing some calling, kind of like the dude from Close Encounters of a Third Kind when he's like building the mashed potatoes. That was me. And I did it in my kitchen. And my first guests were anybody stupid enough to come over to my house and talk to me.
I love it.
And that's how it started. So this is before a personal brand was anything and before any of that. And again, I just promised the universe and all of my fans at that point, which were zero, that I would do an episode every Sunday, no matter what. That was my commitment
so
to
smart.
Myself and the world. And that's what we did. I remember I didn't have a guest 1 week and there was a homeless dude that I kept seeing at the Sainsbury. And I was like, I'm going to get the homeless guy and we're going to have a cool conversation. And I went up to him like, would you like to come on my show? And I told him all about it. And I'm like, yeah, and he said, no. And I said, what do you mean? Like, and he said, nah, I was on BBC Radio one time. I didn't like it. And that was it. So I remember being desperate for guests. And we just took it 1 week at a time. and try to make it a little bit better each time. That's what, that's like the story of my life. Trying to make it like 1% better. Like, can we do better? Can I be better? Can I talk better? Can we get a better guest? Can we get better cameras? Can we... And that just iterated and iterated. And then pretty soon I had a member of parliament on the show. Pretty soon I had Tim Ferriss on the show. Pretty soon I had Dorian Yates, 6-time Mr. Olympia in the UK. And that would be like a step function and a step function. But it took a long time and a lot of banging the head against the wall. Yeah. But now that asset is so valuable. Because I meet people all over the world that they watched an episode that meant something to them. And it's amazing to hear that our episode with you continues to bring in leads. So, that's...
And you never know, right? You never know who it is or who you're impacting. I get daily, and from some of you, daily feedback of, thank you for changing my life. And I said, why didn't you change your life? Something I said... is something other people have said. One of the things that sticks out to me, one, meditation, because you and I come from a similar background. Very, our identity was tied to our bank accounts. And I have the exact same curve. You know, I was running the most notable sports agency in the world. So not only was I making a shitload of money, but everybody thought I had the best job in the world, Jerry Maguire. And I was miserable. And I met this lady who was trying to convince me, Dr. Sangeeta Sahi from India, about meditation. And there has to be this transition when you're resistant to meditation. My initial true story reaction to her was, first, do you know who I am? And I don't have enough time to meditate. I have a Ferrari. I have a beautiful, like, this is in my head, right? I'm looking at her going, like, why do I need to meditate? I have everything. And then she was smart enough to hit me with something that would motivate me. She talked about awareness, frequency. And meditation, elevating my awareness so I could be make this better decisions. And I still told her, don't have time. And then she said, well, that's too bad because I could raise your awareness of when to buy or sell. Now, you're a Wall Street guy. I'm also an investor. I can't think of anything more valuable than knowing when to buy or sell. Like, literally, if you know when to do that, you will be a billionaire very quickly. So she suckered me into meditation, and it changed my life. To that end, there's this self-image versus what I call FOPO, the fear of other people's opinion. When you're established, it's not just our identity. It's, you know, what are people going to say when I do this podcast that nobody's listening to and with nobody of renowned stature? Now, I was even luckier than you because I was running the most notable sports agency in the world. So I had no audience, but I had the biggest names in sports. Right, which was even worse, to be honest, because I wish I didn't interview those people. In fact, if anybody here want to do a podcast or have a podcast, I'll give you the best piece of advice. Do 10 episodes and do not post them. First of all, it puts you in the top 1% of podcasts, right? Most people quit before they get to 10 episodes. Yeah. And two, you'll actually learn about podcasting in those first 10 episodes, and you won't waste your best guess because you think it's cool you have a podcast and you can get the prime minister on. Do not put your prime minister on in the first 10 episodes. How about you? What and how did you overcome what I think is the biggest resistance that people have in anything they want to do, which is my self-identity, limited, and fear of other people's opinion?
Yeah, the identity's big because I was kind of the banker guy, and it was just that.
You're the MIT banker guy.
Yeah, I introduced myself in the beginning, and then no one knew what a podcast was, for God's sakes, you know, in general. And then in the UK, usually about 5 years behind, you know, America for tech. So, man, it was hard. And again, literally nobody was watching those first few years. And I was just like, what am I doing? Wasn't making money.
Right.
Everyone thought I was insane. I did this TED Talk in 2014 when I said most of my banker friends think I'm crazy. Some of them still think I am, and some of them are right. And here I was doing this crazy thing. I remember, I think the my lowest point, whatever this means, is I printed up flyers, and I was walking around Liverpool Street Station handing out flyers, and I was terrified I was going to bump into one of my old buddies, and they were going to be like, really, Brian?
Right. Your basement has a basement. Yeah.
But like, in a weird way, like, that's kind of, they always say founders have to do things that don't scale. And that's what I was doing, you know, to learn something or get somewhere. So that was a weird journey. For me, I was just enjoying the process so much. You know, I loved having these conversations. It was a new skill set. And I was changing as a person in a big way, and I could just sense it. I was just getting different energy and different friends, and I was just obsessed with building this one thing. We just didn't get that many views in the beginning, and so I just didn't really worry about what other people would think. And then when 9 years later, when we got in real big trouble and we started getting dropped by social networks and the BBC was going after us, then I really didn't care because I knew we were doing something right.
Right.
And so at that point, I just kind of gotten hardened to it.
And you have to. Now, community building, you know, so many people don't know their timing and risk tolerance of building a community. And they see you, people like you and I, but they don't see you standing at with flyers. And when I do my meetups, nobody sees years ago, I think Liam talked about when I was in Dublin, and I do these meetups, and I've committed every city I go to a minimum of an hour to do a meetup, and I'd pray that I wouldn't get shut out. Right. And Liam said that he came to a meetup 5 years ago and there was one person. Right. And like now we get kicked out of lobbies of hotels. But that's what people see when they come to a meetup today. How do you encourage in this idea of community building? Because it does take more time and more money today than when we started.
Yeah.
That's the only thing when you say there's too many of them. The only differentiator, it takes more time and more money to build a community because there's more community builders. That's why people like Rogan and Gary that started before us even have even bigger communities because they stuck to what we do every day and they grew that community, but you still can grow it. What is your philosophy on community building when you're talking to people that are trying to build a community for their specific topic, subject, or expertise?
Yeah, so I had Gary actually on the show, I think in 2014, and he came to my studio and we had a really good conversation, even though his people were like,
right,
gotta go, like it's past 40 minutes, but we kept him for over an hour, which was nice. But you know, back then we didn't know the value of a personal brand. And back then you didn't have these CEOs that were brands. Like we didn't talk about Elon Musk or Tim Cook. Honestly, the CEO—
or Gary Vee.
Yeah, okay, they'd hide behind the brand and it was always like the corporate website was boring. It wasn't like the CEO leads with the controversy like a Bezos and stuff. So now we know that's important. I guess all of you know that's important, maybe more important than the product. So first of all, it's not too late. We see that all the time. Random celebrity, random business person starts a podcast and it's a hit. I watched this, the All In podcast, which are these four kind of wealthy, not entrepreneurs, successful tech guys. And they just started doing it during COVID because they wanted to talk to each other. And now it's kind of blown up. So it's never too late. There's always a chance to do that. And look, I think it's important that you're passionate about what you're doing and that you consistently do it. That's really important. So every week is a minimum. You probably need to do it twice a week or three times a week if you really want to grow. But once a week, you'd be surprised. After 10 weeks, you got 10 eps and now you're legit. So you can really do it. It will, by definition, improve your business. It's a great relationship builder. I would say that the most beautiful question any human wants to hear is, would you like to be on my podcast? And it's hard to say no. And people think, oh, I need numbers and stats and a history. Actually, most people will say yes. Mm-hmm. They don't even need to check your numbers. You'd be amazed.
PR people will, but direct people won't.
Yeah. And it's a great way to build a relationship because my first, the beginning of all my relationships with over 1,000 guests is, I'm going to give you something. In my case, it was a 6-camera, high definition, beautifully produced episode that I'm going to put on all these social platforms that are going to give you value for 10, 20 years. And I'm not going to charge you anything and I don't want anything from you. So it's an amazing way to start that relationship. And again, that long form piece can become smaller pieces and it will keep giving. I personally believe that 1,000 years, 10,000, 100,000 years from now, somebody will watch my episode with Dave. I really believe that's true. Now, when YouTube deplatformed me, I was not sure about that, but we're back. And so, but I really believe that. So I go with that intention. I also make sure I enjoy it. I always used to say when I'm in that leather chair, and I'm looking across to the guy across from me, and I don't want to talk to him. That's the day I'm going back to the city, and I'm going to go, you know, sell my soul and get cashed out. So for me, it was important that I wanted to be in there. And that's what makes me different than a BBC host or any of this garbage you see on mainstream TV, because they don't care. They didn't write the questions. They didn't book the guest. And they're thinking I'm going to leave by 5.
Yep.
And if the BBC goes down, I don't care. For me, it's like, I really want to talk to you. I went out of my way to find you and I want to learn from you. And if the cameras were off, I would still be doing this. So if they're off, I don't care. because I get to sit with Dave, or I get to sit with, you know, all these amazing people. So I think with that kind of intention is great. Also, people used to complain that I didn't have guests that were whatever. And I'd be like, well, when you have your show, you can choose your guest, but I'm going to choose my guest. So when I did that, I ended up creating something that I liked. If you like it, probably other people like it. And then the community flowed on the back of that. I was always trying to provide value and just put people that I thought were interesting. Also, a lot of times I disagreed with what the people were saying. Yeah. And I just found a way to just hold my tongue and shut up. And what I found over time was, is that they changed my opinion. And a lot of British broadcasters criticized us because we wouldn't constantly object like you see them doing on the BBC, because I guess that's journalism. That's bullshit. You know, I think it's more important to listen to someone and then allow yourself to form an opinion. So we kind of helped create this new form of media alongside the Rogans and all of that. So just to come back to community, if I built that, we just found that we had a lot of people engaging with it. And again, there was that moment in my interview with David where he said something in minute 43 that happened to change someone's life that needed to hear that at that point in the world. And thanks to the Google algorithm, it probably served it up to you. And for you, that was a minute 43, and for you, that was minute 12, and for you, you never saw it. But it's just amazing how powerful that content is, and that builds that community over time. And I can't, I don't know what the value of my community is. Is it worth 10 million, 100 million? Is it worth $1 billion over the next 50 years or 100? I don't know. Yeah. It's super valuable, though.
I mean, and it definitely will be worth more than it is today.
Yeah.
And how many assets can you guarantee it will be? One of the other things as well, I talked about the perpetuation, curation of community. And I had a coaching client, I actually referred to Kim and Justin, and, you know, I'm coaching them, and it became very apparent, you know, we start, when you talk about coaching, I'm a mindset, heartset, and handset coach, and some people just want to hire me for proximity. Like, there's a variety of reasons. You kind of get that this guy wanted 1 million followers. He hired me, nothing of mindset, and he just wanted 1 million followers, and I was like, Steve, man, I go, I got to be honest, I'm going to have to fire you. And I said, but I will get you 1 million followers before I fire you. He's like, really? I'm like, yeah, you can buy them, right? Like, just fucking, I got six guys that'll sell you 1 million followers if that's what you want. I said, but before I fire you and get you your 1 million followers, like, what do you really want? Like, how, I want you to call me back. Think about what you really want, why you really want to hire me, because I can't believe it's 1 million followers. Why do you want the 1 million followers? So he came back to me and he said, I know what I want. I said, what do you want? He goes, 7 followers. I said, oh, now you're talking something that I can help you get. He goes, yeah, I have 7 $5 million villas in Exuma that I need to sell, and I need these 7 people. I said, now there's a quantifiable value that Dave Meltzer can help you with. And he got it. And so we've been working with Justin and Kim too, because now he has a coaching, you know, he has high-end coaching where he makes a ton. And he has a very small, he has a podcast, a very small, what I call leadership, not following. Because these are all leaders, all in the, you know, construction. They're guys who are building, whoever had the hotel, you know, you're a perfect guy to work with this guy, because he helps people take those small ones, because he does big projects. And so if you know how to do a 20-room hotel, he'll teach you how to do a 2,000-room hotel. And, it, you know, situational knowledge I don't have. But for you, have you curated your community, or is it still just a broad broadcast type of community where you started?
I mean, for us, YouTube ended up being the single most important platform. And it was something we were on from the beginning, and it was the long-form content. And that's what made it harder later when they took us down, because we had millions of subscribers, which are very hard to get. But that's how you build a great relationship with people, like logging that time with people, all those hours. And so then we spread to other communities as well. When we started turning into a business about 3 years after we started, then we started getting these sub-communities.
Yeah.
So again, I was slow to turn it into a business. You know, and your customers will always tell you what they want and how they can give you money if you listen. And I wasn't listening. They were like,
great,
you know,
lesson.
Yeah, Brian, why don't you teach us how to build a business online? Why don't you teach us how to do a podcast? And I was like, I'm too busy with the next guest. And I was just focused on content, content, content. And then when we finally flipped the switch and sold a product, it was incredible. I was shocked that people were willing to pay us thousands of dollars. This was kind of early too, when people weren't talking about it online. But we had spent so much time just building a community through giving value that then it was just very easy. So we started getting these sub-communities of people that would join our podcast course or our business development course or come to an event and then later to invest alongside of us into these projects. And that's when we started kind of really pulling them in. We had a couple membership things where people could connect with each other. And yeah, that's the communities kind of became small business units, I guess, in the end.
I called them buckets at first because people were like, hey, can you do this? And I'd start kind of look for clues and patterns. But also, there was a fear of monetization. And I think there's this real crux. Now, I was in a position maybe like you where I had a business. So the podcast was for purpose. And so then it became unholy. I would never ask anyone to pay to come to a mastermind. I would just do free meetups. This was embarrassing to me. And one of the things that shifted the paradigm for me was someone told me, David, you know, when you're able and capable of helping another person, you're closest to God. And when you are cheating other people of that, so receiving became a big part. There's this duality of people who just want to monetize a podcast that'll never work. And then there's people, ironically, who don't want to monetize their podcast and they could. What have you learned between these two types of people?
The biggest lesson I learned is if you don't charge your customer for something, then they're not going to value it and take it seriously.
Amen.
That's the biggest thing. And so a free podcast course, someone will show up for the first thing and they'll never finish it. I charge you $3,000 for it, you'll get 10 episodes. And that's counterintuitive to much of us think, especially when you think about monetizing my podcast, because you think, oh, I got to pull a fast one. I'm doing this and now I'm going to do this. And like, don't do that. Like there's some beautiful businesses that never got started because of that mindset. You know, no, I'm going to make a charity. You know, I'm sorry. Like, forget your charity. Make a business. A business lives. Mm. Giving things away for free, it does not live. You know, when you sell something, you create revenues. You can create more value, create more shows, more guests, more this. So charge your customer for something. Get them to pay, and then they get them to show up for it. And don't feel bad about that. Matter of fact, it's selfish not to do that.
I agree.
I believe. And the more you charge them, the more they're going to show up. And the better customer you're going to have and the more results you're going to get. And I've noticed that like constantly along. So I think that's really important. I think the media is a great way for people to know who you are and the brand and to give great value. But I think it has to come with a product ecosystem that can range to a lot of different things. And that can change over time. I mean, with London Real, I've changed directions so many times. Maybe it's not the right business decision. I don't know. But it's worked every single time.
It's so good. In line with that, remember, perceived value is just what your level of confidence and comfortability in asking. Bottom line's math. Remember, 80% of business, as far as I see, would bankrupt you. And what I mean by that is 80% of most people's businesses either break even or lose money. And that means that 20% is, if you are profitable, are carrying that. So you should fire everybody that you're losing money with and give it to your competitor and then focus in on making the break-even people profitable and then double all down from the people you were spending losing money with, put it on the people you're making money with, and those will double even faster. And it's true in podcasting. And so charging, though, two things. People won't pay. I like to guarantee everything I do, including this mastermind. I'll tell people, don't come if you can't afford it, because I can't deal with that pressure, because it's hard to wear well on someone that can't afford something. So I'm not one to say, oh, you know, put it all on your credit card. You know, not for me. If you can't afford it, I have other things for you to do for free. And two, if you're not going to engage, it's not worth it, because I'm going to guarantee it for you. And if you're not at least mentally in that place that you only want people that can afford it and are engaged, you don't have to guarantee it. Not everybody can afford to do that. I can, but you should have that in your mind. I'm guaranteeing value to everybody. For you, do you feel there's a guarantee of value with whatever, whether it's investments in Dubai? Do you have that mental in your that I'm actually giving them more than they realize?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm always in with them and I'm all in with them. So like in Dubai, it's like I've moved there full time. You know, and I've shown everybody that this is what I'm doing. I'm investing with you and I'm changing locations of the city that you know, I named my show after. So you can see me on the ground, no matter what's happening in Dubai, no matter what's flying in over the skies, I'm there. So I try to just show them that I'm all in with them. And same with the podcast. It's like, if I teach you how to do this, you can see all of my failures. You can see me coming through, and I want to see you kind of get those results. So maybe it's more implied.
What's the market like in Dubai? So a lot of people aren't familiar. You're in the luxury market in Dubai, and I'm in the luxury market in different cities. For example, the luxury market in Chicago is like 1/10 of that of California, which is still about 70% of New York. Right, what you can get. Yeah. So, like, what can you get in Dubai in that luxury side?
Dubai's a fascinating place. How many people here been to Dubai? Okay.
A lot.
Quite a few. Yeah, it's big in the UK. Americans are slowly starting to come and invest as well. I ran for mayor in 21 because I wasn't too happy with the way they were treating my city. They were locking it down and making all these mistakes. We had fought back in media the year before against all the lockdowns, and then I wasn't too impressed with the current mayor. He's still there. And so we ran for mayor, spent 7 months, millions of pounds, lost. And at the time, we needed a shift. And we went heavy into the blockchain space. We started investing and teaching it. And that brought me to Dubai. Dubai really shocked me. It's not what you think it is. It gets kind of this rep. But I found it to be an amazing place with incredible people. And everybody there, whether you're an Uber driver or the Deliveroo person or whatever, is making a better life for themselves. I love the vision. I love the leadership. We had been using special purpose vehicles to pool people's investments to invest in tech companies through London Real Ventures. And I met one of the biggest brokers there, and I did a show with him. Again, the beauty of podcasts. And after the show, I said, look, this is what I'm doing in tech. He's like, Brian, I've got something that's making me more money than my brokerage business. It's this luxury transformation business. We're in and out in 12 to 14 months. We use special purpose vehicles. You know how to do that. Most real estate guys don't. You should really see this. It's very niche, very specific. And he showed it to me, and we really went all in over the last 18 months. And that's what we've been doing. Look, there's a lot of fireworks in Dubai lately, and we've seen this kind of bifurcation of the market. So if you're looking for the typical tourist buy, which is a one-bedroom place in a high-rise, that market probably is going to be a little soft for the next 12 months. But ultra-high-net-worth people have been moving there the last 5 years, and they need a really nice $20, $30, $40 million house, and they're not building those to spec in Dubai. They don't have a history of doing the bathrooms and the marble work, et cetera. And so they're willing to pay premiums if you can rebuild those homes for them. And that's what we're continuing to do. We do it with special purpose vehicles, so anybody in the world can invest with as little as $50,000 and get in on a trend where you need 10 or 20 million to really do one home. We do project per project. We only work in the top four areas that people are still moving into. And so we have this very weird market right now where some people say, oh, nobody wants to be there, but it's like the wealthy people know something we don't know because they see this in the next 10 years and this is the place for them. So that's what we're doing now. I love a new project. And so we've kind of gone all in. We did a reality show called Dubai Real where I'm walking around in my crazy colored suits to all these wealthy, you know, luxury mansions. And I'm asking all the hard questions, all the stupid questions. And it's been kind of fun to do that. And that's called Dubai Real. And I'm really enjoying it. I love the Gulf. I love the mentality. I'll always love London, but I really think that's the future. And so that's what we're doing. We use the media as well. And so that's this media-powered investment firm. So yeah, I'm having fun.
Yeah, it's good stuff. SPVs, SMAs, those are the two vehicles that most people are using for minority interest in. I just participated in one to buy the A's, the Las Vegas Athletics. So same type of really great way to leverage other people's relationship capital and situational knowledge. To get into, especially the way the world's going, the separation of great wealth is much more secure if you can participate with people of great wealth. Last question real quick. Yeah. Like me, thousands of interviews. Besides me, what was one of your favorite interviews and why?
I used to say it's like asking for my favorite child. You know, you don't have one, but of course you do. there's one guest that I can never separate myself from. He's been on my show 13 times. He's a very famous conspiracy theorist called David Icke. And most people know us for our conversations with him. I actually refused to have him on the show for 3 years because I thought he was insane. He sat down with me in 18, and I thought, he's not as crazy as I thought he was. I don't know about the lizards, but everything else sounds about right. And then when everything kicked off in 2020, I remember I was in the gym. I was in this WhatsApp chat with a bunch of high-level doctors, and they were like, we expect 1.5 million people to die from the COVID. And I was like, damn, who could tell me what's going on here? And I called up David, and David and I had these epic interviews that broke the internet, pissed off the BBC, pissed off Ofcom, got us deplatformed from everybody around the world, and made us infamous and famous at the same time. And so I had 13 episodes total with David. We had the second largest YouTube live stream in the world on April 6, 2020. That episode was then banned and deleted afterwards, which really pissed me off. And we then created our own streaming platform a month later in the middle of lockdown and streamed it to 1 million people as an ultimate kind of fuck you to the system. And I'll always have a relationship with David. He's an incredible guy. I don't agree with everything he says, but he's sure is right about a lot. So he's probably up there. He's a really unique guy. He comes in and then he's like, I'll see you later, Brian. He goes to the pub, has a meal and goes home. You know, he's somehow untouchable in his sense, but he's probably one of my favorites and something I'll be judged for the rest of my life. That and Dan Pena, the Trillion Dollar Man, who's very controversial, who I'll probably go to hell.
Have to admit, Brian Rose is one of my favorites here, and I'm blessed to have him in person to return the favor. We have to do this more. You're incredible. I'm looking forward to investing with you as well, so thank you for that opportunity. The incredible Brian Rose. Amazing. I'm David Meltzer. This is Entrepreneurs, the Playbook. Thank you so much. Definitely.